I'm Rick Gamley. This is NHPR News. It's 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and here are some of the voices you heard this week on NHPR.
The middle class is really getting squeezed right now. Rising health care costs, higher tuition bills, lower take-home pay. And we have a government that can't get anything done.
Police say Darian Hess was behind the wheel on Ocean Boulevard in Hampton Saturday morning when her car crossed the median and struck four cyclists, all from Massachusetts. Two of the cyclists did not survive, Pamela Wells and Elise Bouchard.
New Hampshire, I read today, has one company on the exchange. That is a screw-up. If you don't have a competitive marketplace, it's your job to go make sure you do.
Students could wear khaki pants. Girls could wear shorts. Boys could wear shorts. Girls could wear skorts or capris, anything like that, but all khaki material and a polo shirt of varied colors.
Now, if they put 125-foot towers in front of my house, I guarantee you I'm going to ask for a reduction in price.
That was former 1st District Congressman Frank Ginta, NHPR Seacoast reporter Emily Corwin, former Vermont Governor Howard Dean, Pinkerton Academy headmaster Mary Anderson, and Democratic State Representative Linda Lauer of Bath. Lauer spoke at a U.S. Department of Energy event this week. The department was in the Granite State for a series of so-called scoping meetings on the Northern Pass. DOE is gathering public input before it draws up an environmental impact statement on the hydropower project, and every event from Concord to Colebrook was packed as opponents and supporters made familiar arguments, either that the project will ruin New Hampshire's landscape and all that depends upon it, or that it will mean renewable energy and jobs for our state. From here, the federal government continues to gather comments with a final report due in 2015. Again, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today in The Exchange, and we'll cover this story and many others, including a possible major wrinkle in the debate over Medicaid expansion. Also in politics, Howard Dean makes presidential-sounding noises, and a former New Hampshire Republican U.S. senator says his party should be ignored. Let's hear from you, too, your thoughts about these headlines and many more. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And our guests for the roundup this week are Josh Rogers, senior political reporter here at NHPR. And Josh, good to see you. Thanks for your time.
No problem, Laura. Good morning.
Also with us, Kevin Landergan, staff reporter at the Telegraph of Nashua. And Kevin, welcome back. Good to see you too.
Thanks, Laura.
And also with us, Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, once again, here you are. Thank you very much.
Sure. Good morning, Laura.
Well, I want to ask all of you about the Northern Pass, because as I said, the Federal Department of Energy was here all week holding meetings around the state. As we might imagine, lots and lots of people were there. And Josh, to you first, what's the big picture takeaway from all these meetings this week?
Well, structurally, what the meetings are supposed to achieve were to solicit public comment on that will inform the draft environmental impact statement that the DOE has to produce. I believe that's going to be ready sometime next year. And then there's going to be a final report in 2015. Basically, they want to know what the populace thinks about what Northern Pass might mean to the region. This is going to be required when the DOE determines whether or not the project will be given permission to cross the U.S.-Canada border. You know, the New Hampshire Site Evaluation Committee, a commission will also have to approve, and I believe White Mountain National Forest is involved. Not much new in terms of the rhetoric, what we heard at these hearings. Many, many opponents out in force. Some supporters, mainly organized labor, who are interested in getting the jobs involved with the construction of the project, and politicians from towns that might see tangible economic benefit. The mayor of Berlin, people who represent Franklin, where a number of these jobs would be located, but mostly opponents. And the message was pretty consistent at the hearings across the state. Big turnout against in Concord up north. You know, if you wanted to hear Executive Counselor Ray Burton say one more time that it was time for Northern Pass to pack up its tent and go, that happened this week. But
sounds like the dial hasn't moved very much then, Josh.
Not in terms of – I don't believe so. I mean, I guess we'll see. Obviously, you know, unpopular projects of this sort, you know, they do often get built. So, you know, it can take some time. And obviously this comes in the wake of Governor Hassan being more aggressively opposed to this than she had in the wake of the Boston Globe suggesting that it was a good idea.
Yeah, that was interesting. And that was just about a week ago, wasn't it? Remind us, Josh, because Maggie Hassan did come out more forcefully against this than
well, the Boston Globe had editorialized in support of it, you know, as has, it should be noted, the Concord Monitor. And Governor Hassan issued an op-ed, you know, essentially saying that, you know, butt out Boston Globe, but also that this may not be a good thing for New Hampshire.
Yeah, interesting. And as Josh said, others have said as well, Kevin Landergan, that in terms of how people feel about this project, the dial doesn't really seem to be moving that much, despite lots of meetings by Northern Pass and a big ad campaign. I've heard ads on the radio and seen them in the paper and so forth. What's your sense? Any hearts and minds changing at this point in the process?
It sure doesn't seem so. I think probably what was most disappointing for Public Service Company in New Hampshire was the North Country meeting, because after all, these hearings were a second round of hearings after PSNH had changed their alignment and agreed to bury 8 miles of lines up near the Canadian border. So they certainly should have expected that there would be at least some support for that accommodation that was made in some very sensitive parts of the North Country. But obviously, as we saw at that hearing, opponents outnumbered supporters by some estimates 50-1 at that hearing. So there was actually more support for the project down here in Concord than there was up north. And I think it does speak to the fact that the longer this project is considered by regulators, the more dug in both sides really have become.
That's your sense too, Dean Spiliotis?
Yeah, sure. A couple of things struck me as interesting about the scoping hearings. The first is the glacial nature of the regulatory and permitting process, which may be a good thing in the eye of opponents, as Kevin just said. The sides are getting increasingly dug in. I mean, this has been going on for 3 years. The DOE held 7 scoping meetings in 2011. So now this is an additional iteration.
Because of the new route.
Exactly. And the process itself, as Josh said, you know, there'll be a draft of a environmental impact statement in 2014, an additional comment period, then the final report will come out in 2015. Then there's additional permitting process to go through, and then who knows what kind of lawsuits are going to be generated. So the regulatory process is cumbersome, which, again, opponents that's probably believe that's a good thing. The second thing that struck me is, you know, most of what I've been hearing about the story in recent months is kind of the opposition and the way that the opposition has been dug in. This meeting in Concord, where there were something like 500 people, there actually was a significant labor presence, which was kind of interesting. There were some bucket trucks parked outside. Clearly, people in the electrical and power industries see this as a financial opportunity, as do some of the cities like Franklin, where the converter station will be. The final thing that was interesting is, in terms of understanding the process, you know, my understanding is that, you know, part of sort of the process for the federal government is to make sure that enough alternatives have been considered for how to get this power through the state. So, you know, one of the arguments is going to be that Northern Pass hasn't sufficiently defined what the different alternatives are, whether it's burying all the lines or changing the route yet again. So it is interesting that both sides are dug in. I think the process is still kind of fluid, and there's still a long way to go, you know, several years.
Well, speaking of understanding the process, I want to ask all of you about Medicaid, a wrinkle this week, and that is complicated. But let me also invite our listeners to join us. The number here on the exchange for you to become part of our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Join us as we cover some of the top stories of the week. Your questions and comments on those stories are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And Kevin, I'm going to start with you on this Medicaid piece because you were there. Now, we've talked a lot about this special commission looking at whether New Hampshire should expand Medicaid or not. As envisioned under the Affordable Care Act, New Hampshire's among a handful of states yet to decide. So, Kevin, where are the commission members at now?
Well, at this point, the commission, as you pointed out, has been meeting several months to try and come up with a proposal. I mean, this isn't like some Robert Ludlum or John Le Carre mystery novel. We know where this commission is going to go, how it is set up. There are 9 members, and 5 of them support expansion. So really, the only question has become, what kind of accommodation is going to be made by the majority on this commission to try and get Republican state senators to support it? they need two in order to pass a plan through the legislature.
And let me just jump in, Kevin, because the commission does its thing. There's nine of them.
Yes.
And as you said, more or a slight majority are definitely in favor. But this isn't the end-all be-all, right?
No.
Once this commission does its thing, it goes back to the legislature.
Yeah.
Correct. You're right. I mean, the presumption is that this commission will recommend some expansion of Medicaid, and then Governor Hassan will request the legislature to come back into special session this fall to take up the recommendations of that proposal. But that, as we've seen in the Republican-led Senate, they've blocked any expansion to this point. So it's really all been about there are 13 Senate Republicans, there are 11 Democrats. Governor Hassan needs two Senate Republicans to support any proposal to get through.
So there was big news this week, Kevin, right? I mean, that demonstrated this link between Medicaid expansion, part of the Affordable Care Act, and the healthcare exchanges, which open enrollment this week, right? I mean, the insurance department came in and said, whoa, whoa, this is a big problem.
Yeah. In order to try and get Senate Republican support, the Hassan administration has recognized that with the expansion of Medicaid, we have to try as much as possible to allow these folks to purchase private insurance. So the plan remains essentially for the Medicaid benefit to follow someone as they purchase private insurance. Now, if private insurance is not affordable or is not available at that employer, then the second option would be to allow these folks to buy insurance through the exchange, the federally run Affordable Care Act options for people who
don't
have coverage.
The marketplaces that we've heard so much about, right?
Correct. And the insurance department essentially said this week that it doesn't look as if it's going to be possible for these folks to buy on the exchange because Anthem Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Hampshire is the only insurer on the exchange. And the Affordable Care Act states that there have to be at least two qualified health plans on the exchange for people to have some option for coverage.
Okay, and I've got one or two follow-up questions for you guys on that because it's complicated. We will take your questions and comments, too, after a very short break. The number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, and we'll be right back.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And when you become an NHPR sustaining member, you help NHPR collect an additional $10,000. When 500 listeners become sustainers, we'll receive $10,000 from the Mackinich Foundation and cancel a day from our upcoming fall fund drive. You listen to NHPR. Now it's time to support and sustain us at nhpr.org. New Hampshire weather partly sunny today. We'll have high temperatures in the upper 60s. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Grupponi Automotive Group, providing six auto lines, including Ford, Toyota, and Honda, in a relaxed, stress-free sales environment, driven to amaze and bow and online at Grupponi.com. And Mascoma Savings Bank, serving the people and needs of the Upper Connecticut River Valley since 1899, online at MascomaBank.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're covering some of the major stories that made headlines this week. We were just getting an update on New Hampshire's debate over Medicaid expansion. We'll talk about that in just a moment. Also, we've been talking about the U.S. Department of Energy holding scoping hearings on the Northern Pass project here in New Hampshire this week. You can give us a call on these stories and some of the other headlines that caught your attention. 1-800-892-6477. Send a short email to exchange at nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And Dean Spiliotis, just before the break, Kevin Landrigan was explaining the trouble with Medicaid expansion, or one of the troubles that it's had is Democrats were looking for a way to bring in private markets to this process to make it palatable to Republicans. The problem, Kevin said, is that under the Affordable Care Act, if low-income folks are to buy private coverage on the exchanges under Medicaid, there needs to be two providers, and in New Hampshire, there's only one. There's been a lot of political fallout from this new possible wrinkle.
Right, and one of the themes of the commission, at least on the Republican side, has been this idea that the state needs to figure out some way to work the private marketplace or the exchanges into providing greater coverage through Medicaid. I think, you know, the problem is this is kind of yet another wrinkle or yet another problem that has plagued the rollout of the healthcare exchanges. This is something that Republicans have locked onto as well as they have sought to slow down the implementation of Obamacare. We heard just yesterday that the administration is postponing some of the small business provisions dealing with the insurance marketplace. They've already postponed several other components of the rollout. Not to mention the whole issue this past week in Washington about trying to defund Obamacare while trying to solve a government shutdown. But the reality is this is a big change in how people are insured. The administration has said there are going to be a lot of glitches and missteps. The question is going to be, are there going to be enough kind of difficult anecdotal stories about how this is rolling out? I noted that the Concord Monitor had a front page story about how people are upset about the narrowed options provided by Anthem. So, you know, this is at some level kind of a political public relations problem for the administration. It's just the beginning of it, I think, and it's something that gives Republicans hope that they can find a way to sort of roll it back or at least lessen its impact.
And we talked about those narrowed networks last week and the week before on the roundup. So I won't talk about that right now, but I just want to let everybody know that we did a show a couple weeks back about the exchanges that you mentioned, Dean and Kevin, and how they're coming, and enrollment starts on October 1st next week. We will be doing just a whole show on that to answer listener questions about the exchanges, because people do have so many questions about them. So more on that next week. The number for you to join us right now with your questions and comments is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Post a comment on our Facebook page, too, if you'd like, NHPR Exchange. And I did want to turn to politics with you, gentlemen, for a couple minutes. And Josh, to you first. Frank Ginta wants his old seat back in the 1st Congressional District. Now, just set that up for us, Josh, if you could, please.
Well, it's a seat that Frank Ginta, who was the mayor of Manchester for a while also, won in 2010, came in on a Republican wave, out in 2012, and what ended up being a big Democratic wave, replacing Carol Shea Porter, who won election in 2006, held the seat in 2008, big years for Democrats, and then lost it in 2010. So, you know, I don't yet have a sense of what 2014 is going to be like, but you have two people who have been sort of swept in and out of that seat on big years for their parties. And, Ginta was very much of a piece of the 2010, you know, Republican mindset, was happy to be aligned with the Tea Party, and has come out in favor of, you know, government shutdown more recently.
So he says he is on board with the House Republican plan.
It's interesting in the video announcing that he's going to seek. He struck a more conciliatory tone, didn't mention that he'd ever served in Congress, and said, you know, if we can do things, if we work together for the same goal, that's how we do it in New Hampshire. So, the retooled Frank Ginta, he's gonna have to raise some money, and he doesn't have any on hand. And he will have competitors in this race, but it'll be interesting to see how he walks the line to try to appeal to a broader swath of voters. We're obviously a ways away from Election Day, but, you know, the polls out of UNH show that he's not, you know, terribly popular, although he is the most familiar Republican who so far thrown his hat into the ring. Whether that's a good or bad thing remains to be seen. He will have Paul Ryan, the vice presidential nominee, up here on his behalf, and Kelly Ayotte's going to appear at that fundraiser, which was, you know, some people believe that was a sort of an interesting choice for her so far away from Election Day, but I'll let others weigh in. It'll be interesting to see how
that
Frank
is interesting.
Does.
And I had not heard about Senator Paul coming up, so that's interesting. And I was also interested to hear Josh say, Dean, that in his video saying, yes, I want to get my old seat back, Congressman Ginta really didn't use those words, get my old seat back. Josh said he didn't mention that he had been in Congress before.
Right. This situation illustrates two points for me. The first is the extent to which House seats are subject to these larger currents in the political environment. Josh described perfectly how Carol Shea Porter was swept in. She was then swept out. Ginta was swept in. He was then swept out. House seats are notoriously tied to kind of larger political trends in the country, and we don't yet know exactly what 14 is going to be like. The second thing it raises for me is that you note is kind of the ability of politicians to reinvent themselves. themselves. In 2010, Frank Ginta ran, if not as a member of the Tea Party, as a very closely allied member or politician to the Tea Party. I remember after the election seeing him on CNN on a show with a group of other freshman legislators who were all defined as Tea Party Republicans. And he spoke the language back then. And as this announcement video shows, this time around, he's talking about the need to find common ground and for the government to get things done. Very different tone. I don't know how it's going to play. He's struggled in the past a bit with fundraising. I'm going to be interested to see the extent to which the Republican Congressional Campaign Committee in Congress and also some of the outside groups, should he be the nominee, how they decide whether or not he has a chance to unseat Shea Porter. But again, the big picture is, we figure out what 2014 is going to be, and then we can kind of get a better sense of who has the advantage.
Well, and real quickly, Dean, we've talked before on this program, former Congressman Ginta might have others on the Republican side challenging him for the nomination. Go ahead.
Right. The one we've talked about before is the UNH Business School Dean, former Business School Dean, Dan Innes, who is saying he will have some announcements soon. We've talked before about how he's Republican, he's gay, he's married. I don't know that that will be the central aspect of his campaign. I don't know much about his sort of economics yet. But Frank Ginta, in contrast, has been very socially conservative in the past. So that would be an interesting contrast. And, it suggests some new options for the Republican Party as it tries to kind of rebuild its bench of candidates.
Well, and some more political news, although it's on the presidential front. Kevin Landrigan, a familiar name for many Granite Staters. There's a little bit of buzz about former Vermont governor and former Democratic National Committee chair Howard Dean possibly giving it another shot for the presidency. Is that just talk or is there anything real there, Kevin? What do you think?
Well, I think what it really reflects is not so much the reemergence of Howard Dean, but rather the dispirited liberal Democratic base of the party that's very unhappy with this president and some of the policies. They're unhappy, for example, that he didn't pursue the single-payer system on health care reform and let the private insurance market essentially run a universal coverage. They're unhappy with some of the military decisions this president has made on foreign policy. And they see in Howard Dean obviously a throwback to the 2004 campaign in which he ran against John Kerry very much as a liberal Democrat and someone willing to challenge the authority in both parties. And we heard some of the same message this week when he spoke to the folks at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics. I'm not sure he's viable as a future presidential candidate for a couple of reasons. One, as we know in politics today, changes can occur in an instant. You can become very old news very fast, and Howard Dean falls into that category now. Two, politics is a lot about not only how you enter the stage, but how you leave it. And in 2004, that campaign by Howard Dean not only ended badly for Howard Dean, it ended badly for the Democratic Party, which lost a very bitter race to President George W. Bush for re-election. And I'm not sure a lot of Democrats, even who like Howard Dean, see him as the answer for the future in 2016 when the seat will be open.
Again, the number for you to join us here in The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. We want your questions and comments about some of the top stories of the week that we're looking at, whether it's Medicaid expansion, the Northern Pass, or some of these political names. Joining in the political conversation again for 2014 and 2016, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Facebook is NHPR Exchange. And all of you, let's go to our listeners now. And Carol's waiting in Grantham. Hi, Carol, you're on The Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm going to address the Northern Pass issue. I really wish that the Department of Energy had held some of their hearings further south in the state, because I think a number of us might have shown up. I think that the opponents of the project have a very narrow set of blinders on. And I think from what I heard of what the electric companies are trying to do is to use existing rights of way and to bury the lines in very sensitive areas. I mean, they're just bending over backwards to try to avoid damaging the landscape. Meanwhile, where are we going to get our electricity? Vermont Yankee's closing down, and I don't think anybody's going to be building any more nuclear plants. in this part of the country anyway.
So, Carol,
and
I appreciate the call.
Yeah,
I appreciate the call. And, you know, here's someone who supports Northern Pass. There is a lot of opposition, but there were supporters, Dean Spiliotis, as you said, at these meetings. And Carol's kind of making the point that some at PSNH have made, which is, let's look at the big picture here. Where's the energy going to come from?
That's right. You know, there is, I've sort of read a little bit into the debate about just how necessary this is. One of the arguments that opponents make is that it would be a kind of a nice thing to have, to the extent that, you know, hydropower from Canada might be a kind of a cleaner way to generate energy in the region, but that it's not absolutely necessary. So this is going to be part of the debate. I don't know sort of the criteria for why they set the scoping sites where they did. I mean, they were sort of tilted towards the northern part of the state where there's been a lot of opposition, you know, sort of Colebrook and Whitefield and up in that area. Plymouth, I believe, was one of the – and then Concord. So, you know, this sort of whole debate about kind of renewable energy or cleaner energy and sort of what the trade-offs are, just kind of as a sort of a bigger picture statement, you know, for all these kinds of issues on our state, whether we're talking about wind power or we're talking about other forms of electrical generation, there are real trade-offs in terms of, you know, cleaner energy, whether we need it, the impact on the environment. And I just think this is going to continue to be a spirited debate for as long as it goes on.
Well, there's a lot to think about for sure. And Carol, thank you very much for calling in. The number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And here's a quick email that just came in from Angel, who says, please do not refer to the Affordable Care Act as, quote, Obamacare. That is incorrect and pejorative. Josh Rogers, what do you think?
Well, I think that it started out as pejorative, but the president himself uses that now. And
I think he said at one point he actually likes it.
Well, in his speech yesterday, he actually said that critics are going to stop calling it Obamacare once they recognize that it will work. And I guess we'll see if it works, and we'll see if they stop calling it Obamacare in the wake of its potential success. But, you know, Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act have more or less become interchangeable in the way that people have used. And what was initially a criticism has somewhat leached out of it. And I think that most people in the news business and on the political front these days see it as much more of a value-neutral descriptor than it initially was.
Yeah, Angel's right, though. At first, it was seen that way. But Kevin, again, the president himself has said, hey, this is fine.
Yeah, and I think the president recognized at the end of the day that his belief, one, that once this is fully implemented, it's going to be a lot more popular than the fear that's being cast about it. So I think he embraces the fact he accomplished this historical achievement and is going to live with the result. He knows it's his legacy.
All right. Well, Angel, thanks a lot for that email. And the email address again is exchange@nhpr.org. The phone number, 1-800-892-6477. One more quick question about the Affordable Care Act, if you will. Former Republican House Speaker Bill O'Brien, Dean, made national news, although not by name, for what he said about Obamacare a few months back. Now, we talked about this on the show. A few months back, O'Brien compared the Affordable Care Act to the Fugitive Slave Act. President Obama himself commented on that this week, saying, hey, you know, imagine that. Somebody said that having affordable health care is worse than a law that lets slave owners get their runaway slaves back. Why would the president, Dean, even go there?
Well, I think it's essentially an opportunity to ridicule the Republican opposition to Obamacare, to the extent that Obama can do anything to kind of point out what they see as kind of the ridiculousness of kind of the fears and anxieties about what this is going to mean for the average citizen. They're going to do that. So, that was comparing to the Fugitive Slave Act, which allowed Southern owners to retrieve their property from the North, essentially. By using that example, it's a way to kind of show that that this is all out of proportion to the reality of what the experience is going to be. It was interesting. It also pointed out to me the extent to which, you know, since Bill O'Brien has said he's not running for Congress in the 2nd District, he's kind of dropped just a little bit off of the radar, and then we got him brought back in with this particular thing. But because, again, technology allowed it, that O'Brien comment to be videotaped, and so people around the country were able to see it, and I think Obama wanted to point out sort of that this is an extreme example of fear and anxiety.
Well, and it was interesting. The Democratic Party wasted very little time before sending out a fundraising solicitation in the wake of this. how much longer they have to, you know, kind of milk the O'Brien speakership for money, I guess we'll see. There's no sense that they're going to stop trying. How effective it is, we don't know.
Well, here's an email that came in from Amy concerning another story that I did want to cover for you. A tough story has to do with the Seacoast Century Ride this past weekend, a beloved tradition by many, many in the cycling community, turning tragic when two cyclists were killed. Amy says, I'm an avid cyclist triathlete, but more important, I'm a full-time paramedic in a New Hampshire fire department. I was on a call recently for a young pedestrian hit by a car. The common factor these two stories have is that the drivers were impaired by prescription medication, fentanyl in the case of the cyclist, and Ativan for the pedestrian. While the media coverage seems to bring much attention for drugs like heroin, we in fact respond to more calls for prescription overdoses. I personally feel there should be more attention paid by primary doctors to dispensing these medications, more education to our family, and more media coverage to this abuse. It's not just about blaming the addict. We as a society must take responsibility also. And Amy, thank you for that. And folks, let's talk just briefly about what happened on the Seacoast this week. Dean Spiliotis, this was a huge story. Dreadful. A young woman, 19, hit four cyclists, killing two. This is an event which I did myself in 2010. Hard for me to imagine, Dean, how a driver could not see cyclists. There are literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds in the Seacoast all day. You'd have to have your eyes closed not to see them.
Yeah, and it is a very tragic story, and it's kind of been evolving with multiple layers added in. It's clear that now that this young woman had bought some prescription meds at some point the night before, had been previously stopped for driving very fast without a license, I think twice the speed limit. But the person who sold her the drugs came and got her, took her home, and then she got the car back from her fiancé the next morning. She said she was distracted. You know, we don't know yet. They're going to wait the toxicology to see if she actually had the prescription meds in her bloodstream. You know, was she texting? Who knows? But it's a very sad story, and it's something we hear about a fair bit. And I've heard increasing discussions about the need to kind of refocus attention away from sort of the traditional crack and heroin and things like that, and more to this issue of prescription drug addiction, which apparently is increasingly a serious one. And it may have been involved in this case as well.
Well, we've done multiple shows on that exact issue. And you see from this incident how it just affects, sends ripples of devastation to these families. So we will probably be following up on that story next week as we learn more. You can join us with your emails like Amy did at exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call 1-800-892-6477. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And we'll be back in a minute.
This is NHPR. It's 9:39. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. The House floats a plan to avert a government shutdown. Treasury warns the debt ceiling limit will be reached by October 17th. Then, Iran's president makes his international debut at the UN. All coming up on The Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from UNH Manchester, holding an open house on September 28th for high school and transfer students. More information at unh.edu. And the Rudiger Group, serving successful families and businesses with sophisticated planning and investment management for over 30 years at UBS Financial Services. Member FINRA SIPC. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday in The Exchange, a roundtable of Granite Staters on Iran's new charm offensive and what may be behind it. Email us your questions and comments to exchange@nhpr.org before the show, or call it on Facebook at NHPR Exchange. And then be sure to join us Monday morning live at 9. Today, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. You can join us by calling 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook, again, is NHPR Exchange. And we go now to our colleague Michael Brindley for an update on several Southern Tier stories that he's been following. And Michael, thanks for making time out for us today. We appreciate it.
No problem, Laura.
Well, you had a story just this morning about Pinkerton Academy in Derry considering a dress code. Now, just remind us, Michael, Pinkerton Academy is a public school, right? Despite the name, it sounds like a private school, but it's Derry's public high school, right?
Well, correct. It's privately owned, but the local towns tuition their students to go there. So there is kind of a hybrid there of public-private.
And why are they exploring a possible dress code?
Well, the headmaster, Mary Anderson, says essentially that it's a behavior thing, that they've had to address several dress code violations of their current dress code. So what they want to do is implement what they call a unified dress code, which is actually modeled at the meeting last night. Students would be required to wear khakis, sweater vests, polos, but these are things that they would purchase themselves from a range of colors that they could explore.
So it's not like your typical Catholic school uniforms. It's a little different from that.
It is, but a lot of the parents who were there were pretty upset last night, and what they saw, they described as a uniform. They said, if I wanted my student to wear a uniform, we would go to a private school.
Yeah, so what do you think overall is going to happen, given that they had this exploratory meeting? Officials were careful, Michael, right, to point out that this is not a done deal.
Correct, and they said they were taking input. This is not done, but the headmaster has said that this is a proposal that they want to take to the Board of Trustees, who ultimately would make that decision. So this was a kind of exploratory meeting to gauge the parental interests.
Okay, and another story that you covered in the Southern Tier this week is Nashua, your hometown, Michael, rebranding itself, a $105,000 campaign with a new slogan. Okay, so drum roll, please, Michael. What's the new slogan?
Dare to begin.
Dare to begin. Now, what does that mean?
Well, the city officials see that as a way of showing businesses that this is a place where you can dare to begin new challenges. They say it harkens back to the city's past of people taking those challenges and dares, and that's why the city is what it is now. But they also see it as kind of a look to the future as well. So this is the city's official new brand.
And that $105,000, in fairness, it was part public and part private money. It wasn't all city money. Is that correct, Michael?
Correct. $50,000 in city money. The Chamber of Commerce then raised $60,000 through private organizations and businesses.
Well, and what's been the reaction can I still call it the Gate City, or do I have to call it the Dare to Begin City now?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. But I was there at the unveiling on Wednesday, and, a very positive crowd. A lot of people, I would say 200 to 300 people showed up. A lot of local business leaders are very excited about it. You know, so I would say the city leaders, very enthusiastic. But, you talk to people. I've talked to several, residents, and I think a lot of people aren't too excited about it, but I think they're trying to give it a chance, trying to understand what that means, dare to begin. I think for business leaders and city officials, it has a certain meaning, but I think for regular citizens, it may not resonate with them. So we'll see how that works out.
Well, last question for you on this, Michael. Why did Nashua feel it needed a rebranding? I was there a year or two ago. Seemed like a pretty nice place.
Well, I think they're trying to kind of put themselves on the map. I mean, they are seen as a kind of a technology hub. I think they want to branch off of that and kind of build off of that. And so I feel like they felt they needed some sort of new identity for businesses, considering Nashua as a potential home residence, potentially looking at Nashua. So I think they just felt they needed a new kind of rebranding.
All right. Well, Michael, thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem.
That's NHPR's Michael Brindley, again, updating us on a couple Southern Tier stories that he covered this week. You can join us, too, with your questions and comments about some of the top stories in the news that caught your attention. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Again, post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. 1-800-892-6477 is the number. And gentlemen, we talked politics earlier, and there was one more political story I did want to follow up with you on. And Josh Rogers, an editorial by former U.S. Senator Judd Gregg, former New Hampshire governor, former member of Congress, sort of an esteemed Republican official here in the Granite State for many, many years, wrote an editorial for the magazine The Hill, saying that people should ignore Republicans. What was that about?
Well, he was essentially decrying what he described as, and I'm quoting here, the self-promotional babble of a few has become the mainstream of Republican political thought. I think I don't know who specifically. I mean, certainly Ted Cruz springs to mind as Judd Gregg's an establishment Republican, one of the most successful Republican politicians in New Hampshire history. You use the word esteemed. He's not terribly liked among many sort of rank and file Republicans. They sort of admire him. But if you go around to GOP events, you don't hear a great deal of people expressing love for Judd Gregg. But, he did a lot for the party in his day. And you know, this is part of an ongoing debate going on in the GOP around the country, in New Hampshire, about, you know, its future. It's easy to get along when people are – when things are riding high and, you know, it's sort of like the difference between governing and campaign mode. And, you know, Judd Gregg is right that getting rid of Obamacare, which is something that Judd Gregg would like to do, is not going to happen immediately. And grinding the government to a halt because you haven't been able to do that may not be in the long-term interest of the Republican Party.
That's certainly what he said in his editorial.
There is a sort of cultural fight going on within the party. You could see it with the Speaker O'Brien comments that were mentioned, invoked by the president. It's interesting to see there was former Speaker O'Brien came back and, you know, sort of defended his comments and described the president as being, he's just still a rabble-rouser. And, you know, it was interesting there was a tweet from Fergus Cullen, who's sort of a former Republican Party chair, more of an establishment sort of Republican looking and you could argue that, you know, Bill O'Brien has done more for the Republican Party of late than Fergus Cullen did as chairman, certainly, and a lot of conservatives would. But he said, you know, O'Brien's wrong. His argument is, absurd, essentially. It was, an expanded version of the tweet. So, you know, there's a fight in the Republican Party going on right now, and it'll be interesting to see where it goes. Whether or not people, New Hampshire activists, are going to pay particular attention to what Judd Gregg said in The Hill, I doubt. But it's interesting that he would go so far.
All right. And here's an email that came in from Robin about what's happening with the Democrats. And I'll throw this to you, Kevin, because I think this is picking up on something that you said. Robin says, Howard Dean isn't dispirited with Barack Obama. He's positioning for a vice presidential nomination under Hillary Clinton. The only way to run for VP is to run for president with strong ties to some faction and make a strong showing with that faction. Robin, thanks for the email. Kevin?
Yeah, interesting theory, Robin. And certainly it's something many people have done in the past. Witnessed Joe Biden becoming vice president for Barack Obama. And Howard Dean has made it clear that he supports Hillary Clinton if she runs for president in 2016. So, and certainly he's going to be looking for work probably after 2016. Howard Dean is someone, whether his electability has passed, certainly his energy level has not. I see him very much involved in a future Democratic administration, if there is one.
Well, and one more quick question for you, Dean, on the Democrats. It's interesting. We've talked a lot about this program over our many Fridays about different Republicans, you know, considering a run for president. But I have read recently, correct me if I'm wrong, that there's really not been a lot of movement on the Democratic side because everybody's waiting to see what Hillary will do.
Absolutely. The polling data has been very consistent over the last several months. You know, at least in New Hampshire, she's typically up over Joe Biden by something like 50 percentage points. She's got something like 60, roughly. She comes in the 50s and 60s in terms of percent of support, and Biden is typically down 8, 10, 15, 13%, something like that. So, there are other people like, you know, Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley has talked about exploring a run. There are other people who are waiting to see what she does. And it's funny, I have talked to a number of Democrats who are very upset about kind of the inevitability aspect of this because they feel like it's going to preclude a healthy debate within the party. And that's interesting because it does feel a little bit like it's inevitable. But others are saying the party needs to have a discussion with more than one candidate. But she's way ahead at this point.
Josh, real quick.
Well, things can change quickly. And sure, there's no doubt that the establishment in New Hampshire, you know, is very comfortable and supportive of Hillary Clinton. It's also true that familiarity can breed contempt, and the more you see the Clintons in action, there are certainly segments of the Democratic Party that simply do not like them, and so there will be people there will be others running, even if Hillary runs, and certainly one would be a fool at this point to not assume that she would do quite well in New Hampshire.
All right, let's take another call if we could. Gretel's waiting in Brownsville, Vermont. Hi, Gretel. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air.
Yeah, I actually called to address one issue, but two issues have come up, and I'm going to try to be really quick because they're both examples of people refusing to take responsibility. This issue about uniforms, I'm a school teacher, and the parents let their girls, especially girls, go to school half-dressed and exposing just glands. Yeah. Parents should take some responsibility for how their girls leave the house.
Boy, Gretel, we could do a whole hour on this because I hear this from mothers and fathers of girls, and I don't have girls, so I'm not dealing with it. But go ahead, Gretel. What was your other point?
At the school, we have sweaters, big, ugly sweaters, the girls have to put on. So we don't impose uniforms. We impose big, ugly sweaters.
What was your other point, Gretel, because we're running close to the end?
My point is about the people who were killed. When you take drugs and get in a car, before you take the drugs, you've made a decision to be a dangerous person. And to have only 7 years as your maximum sentence for killing somebody when you're driving under the influence is outrageous, absolutely outrageous. And that's another example of the grown-ups, the legislation, not taking responsibility when individuals refuse to take responsibility.
Now, from what I read, and thank you, Gretel, so much for the call, and anybody correct me here if I'm wrong, please. The girl, she's 19, four felonies right now, so 3.5 to 7 years for each. So that sounds like a max of 28 years if there's the full 7 years applied to each felony. But Gretel's right. You never know how much is going to be applied in these crimes. Kevin, we can't get too specific on this now because it's ongoing. But I do want to tap into Gretel's feeling that this person, through an extremely bad, careless choice, took two lives. How is the public going to feel if she doesn't get a large prison sentence?
Well, that's certainly, I think what Gretel's speaking to is what a lot of people are feeling right now, that this punishment should be greater, but that's the way it is under the statute. I would wait for this case to play out. Once toxicology tests, for example, come back on what was in her system, it's possibly charges could be upgraded depending on how high it is. There are additional sanctions if you commit motor vehicle manslaughter or vehicular homicide, and you're so drugged driving, whether it's alcohol or it is drugs, they could actually seek an enhanced penalty. That may well come here because based on some of the witnesses, it sure seems as if she was very unbalanced, not only when she hit those bicyclists, but even after. She was still driving in the same lane.
Wow.
And only later moved over to be on the right side of the road. So
it's just heartbreaking. Again, this is such a celebration of bicycling and the outdoors and the seacoast. And
it is, too. And I wouldn't be surprised to see policymakers take a look at that first instance, which is to say she was driving, as Dean pointed out, twice above the speed limit.
Without a license.
Without a license. And that's only a motor vehicle violation. So I think legislators probably will take a look at that and see whether there are cases in which, again, we can charge an enhanced penalty for someone who's driving without a license but commits either extreme speeding or dangerous actions on the road that put people at risk.
All right. Well, Gretel, thanks a lot for your call. We do appreciate it. And I'll be thinking about those big, bulky sweaters that you make the teenage girls put on before they come into school. Let's take one more call, if we could. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. John in Manchester. Go ahead, John. You're on The Exchange. Thanks for calling in on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup.
Good morning.
Morning.
So I've just felt with all along, and it sort of has been playing out, that the New Hampshire Republican Party has been delaying this approval, of course, of the exchange money and the accepting of the Medicare money for the health care exchanges in the hopes that this program will implode. But if you see it start to roll out, I think you're going to have a lot of voters really angry if New Hampshire doesn't get on board. And the words of Judge Gregg this week were fascinating. I never thought I'd agree with a man, but it shows you just how far right the Republican Party has slipped that I can listen to him and say, I miss the days when Judge Gregg ran Rancher politics as opposed to a nut job like O'Brien, who basically has been on your show so many times. It's basically his campaign center junior.
Well, so many times. I know. Be a little more fair there, John. I don't think Bill O'Brien's been on this show so many times. He's been on, I don't want to count numbers, but so many times, a little of exaggeration. But I do want to talk about your broader point, John. So thank you for calling in. And Dean Spiliotis, that's the politics of this whole thing. You know, it's almost like it's like the old push me, pull you, right? I mean, the deadlines are approaching, things are rolling out, and yet there's this political pushback in the other direction.
Absolutely. And the caller was referring to the possibility of the state getting about $5 million in federal funds to kind of help educate and provide information for the rollout. I believe Republicans in the state Senate blocked that. and Democrats have been trying to find another way around to get at that money. You know, there's sort of two things going on. At the national level, there is this macro level debate about Congress, Republicans in Congress trying to defund Obamacare. We're having the discussions now about funding the government and about raising the debt ceiling. And some Republicans like Ted Cruz are looking to kind of link defunding the program to funding the government. House has had 40 votes on defunding it. But sure, Republicans are looking to trip it up in any way possible.
All right. And John, just to let you know, thanks for the call, by the way. And next week we'll be looking just at the exchanges that are rolling out next week, trying to answer everybody's questions. So if you're interested, join us for that program. And gentlemen, I'd love to close out this Friday New Hampshire News Roundup by asking what you're going to be watching next week. Josh Rogers, what are you going to be working on?
Well, I'm going to be mainly editing next week, but it'll be interesting to see as we gear up towards the rollout of how the exchanges play out in New Hampshire, whether that's smooth sailing or fraught. I think a lot of people are going to be looking at that.
Yeah, and also we didn't have a chance, guys, this hour to talk about the Gambling Commission, but that met this week as well. Kevin, you wrote about that. What are you going to be covering next week?
Yeah, and certainly the Gambling Commission looks as if they're going to come up with a pretty robust regulatory structure, but it's back at Medicaid expansion. I think we're...
That's after, what you'll be following.
Right, after 3 months of just a lot of shadow boxing, we finally get down to horse trading next week.
Yeah, and how about you, Dean?
Watching our congressional delegation over the next 2 weeks as they deal with government shutdown, raising the debt ceiling, possible government default, and attempts to defund Obamacare.
All right. Well, all of you, never a shortage of things to talk about. Dean, thank you very much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Sure. My pleasure, Laura.
Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University, author of the website, nhpoliticalcapital.com. Kevin Landrigan, great to see you. Thank you very much.
Have a great week. Weekend, Laura.
Kevin Landrigan, staff reporter, The Telegraph of Nashua, and Josh Rogers. Appreciate your time. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Laura.
Josh Rogers, senior political reporter for us at New Hampshire Public Radio. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, a Granite State roundtable on the charm offensive from Iran and why some are skeptical about it. Then, with the new health exchanges open, we answer your questions on what they might mean for you. And another look at incarceration. With rising prison populations, there's talk in New Hampshire and nationally about retooling how we approach crime and punishment. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show and the Friday News Roundup, next at 10 on NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from AARP, presenting You've Earned a Say, a community discussion on solutions to keep Medicare and Social Security strong, inviting Granite Staters to join in the conversation at aarp.org/NH. And from GDS Associates, energy engineers and consultants helping businesses and homeowners with diagnostic testing and advice on efficiency and renewable options. Online at gdsassociates.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
It's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Pressure is building on Congress to approve a spending measure and prevent a government shutdown at midnight Monday. Another nerve-wracking deadline looms on October 17th, when the Treasury Department says the nation is likely to run out of money to pay its bills.